this week on COVID, Race, and Democracy.
We must immediately vacate Muskogee homelands and cease violence and policing of Indigenous and Black people in Muskogee lands.
People have been protesting against Cop City since we found out about it in 2021. And our protests have been, since its beginning, met with police violence.
Environmental, civil rights, community organizers, and activists continue to protest against the construction of Cop City in Atlanta, Georgia.
As much as the Russians may overstate the control or influence of Nazis, literally, within the Ukrainian government, the fact remains that since the fall of Franco, the only nation on the planet with actual fascists and Nazis organized as independent units that identify as such, as neo-fascists, within their armed forces is the country of the Ukraine.
David Van Dusen, president of the Vermont AFL-CIO, on the expanding war in Ukraine.
Assuming that humanity is not overwhelmed by climate change or nuclear war, I dare say that a century from now, we'll still be able to draw lessons from the immense legacy of one Paul Robeson.
We honor the 125th birthday of the artist and revolutionary, the great Paul Robeson, whose fight against racism and fascism is as relevant today as ever. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Akua Holt. Environmental, civil rights, community organizers, and activists continue to protest the construction of Cop City in Atlanta, Georgia, a militarized, state-of-the-art, $90 million police training facility. They say it promises little more than environmental degradation and more unwelcome police power. Detractors also say that the Cop City model is police intimidation and violence and prosecutorial overkill, often relying on the domestic terrorism charges to silence all dissent. Pacifica's Thomas O'Rourke filed this report.
Environmental activists known as forest defenders, along with civil rights and community organizers, continue leading protests, tree sit-ins, and street demonstrations in Atlanta, Georgia, as they have for months to oppose the pending construction of the Atlanta Public Safety Training Academy, dubbed Cop City, along with a movie sound studio to be built on land in the South River Forest in southeast Atlanta. Clashes with law enforcement have continued to intensify as opposition to the projects grow. A police raid on December 14th last year resulted in six activists arrested and charged with domestic terrorism. And on January 18th, during another police raid, 26-year-old land defender Manuel Paez Terran, nicknamed Tortuguita, was shot and killed by a hail of cop bullets, while seven other activists were arrested and charged with the same domestic terrorism. The killing of Paez Terran and the utterly suspicious circumstances surrounding the incident, an example being that not a single body camera among dozens of police from five separate police agencies, including Atlanta PD, Georgia State Police, and Georgia Bureau of Investigation, was turned on during the raid and ensuing discharges. The level of hubris and arrogance to kill an environmental activist and then publicly announce that no police followed a required procedure meant to document their actions is both ominous and infuriating, and has contributed to the heightened distrust and attention this case is getting. While the killing of environmental activists and land and water protectors around the world is on the rise, this is reportedly the first such case in the U.S. itself. What follows is the mother of Tortuguita, Belkis Terran, speaking at a rally and press conference to demand answers to the many questions thus far unanswered by Georgia police officials.
My child, Manuel Esteban Paez Terran, was killed here in Atlanta on the 18th of January, 2023. We still do not know anything. It was killed, our most beloved family member and the most caring person that any group of people could have, and there is only silence. Manuel loved the forest, gave them peace. They meditate there. The forest connect them with God. I never thought that Manuel could die in a meditation position. My heart is destroyed. I want answers for my child homicide. I'm asking for answers to my child homicide. I am suffering for my right to this answer, and that I have not been given, and I deserve answers. Thank you.
A major point of controversy for protesters is that Cop City is being built on land that's been deeply intertwined with the plight of Black and Indigenous people for centuries, and the adjacent communities are Black and Brown working class communities with great distrust of massive increases in police power. The Wolani, meaning brown water forest, belonged to the Muscogee Creek Nation until the 1820s and 30s, when white American settlers and the state of Georgia, under cover of an illegal land lottery, violently pushed Muscogee Creek, Cherokee, and others from their land, leading to thousands of deaths before and during the Trail of Tears. After the Civil War, part of the forest was turned into the now abandoned Old Atlantic Prison Farm, which went on to produce a significant fraction of the food and supplies going to Georgia prisons as a cost-saving measure, though the cost forced on inmates, including torture, malnutrition, slave labor, sexual violence, or worse. This hellish institution wasn't officially closed until 1995. A contingent of Muscogee is heard here addressing the Atlanta City Council with historical as well as cultural arguments in opposition to this land development deal.
I have a letter being delivered from the Muscogee Creek Nation on behalf of Muscogee Creek spiritual leadership in opposition to Cox City.
I came all the way on the Trail of Tears to deliver this letter to you folks. We want you to know that the contemporary Muscogee people are now making their journey back to our homelands, and hereby give notice to Mayor Andrew Dickens, the Atlanta City Council, the Atlanta Police Department, the Atlanta Police Foundation, the DeKalb County Sheriff's Office, and so-called Cop City, that you must immediately vacate Muscogee homelands and cease violence and policing of Indigenous and Black people in Muscogee lands. We also ask for an independent investigation into the assassination of our relative Tortuguita, and that the charges be dropped against Wolani Forest defenders.
Today, the land currently provides community green space and multiple parks, bike trails, lakes, a rock garden, cemetery, golf course, sports complex, and more. It was dubbed one of the four lungs of Atlanta in a report from the Department of City Planning, and was supposed to be protective against commercial and residential development to preserve its ecological and environmental benefits, including floodplain restoration, habitat expansion, and tree canopy protection, according to the Nature Conservancy, especially in light of projected population growth tripling Atlanta within 20 years. Despite that background, in September 2021, while COVID lockdowns were destroying livelihoods and lives, Atlanta's City Council voted in favor of the training site, despite having heard 17 hours of comments over a two-day span, primarily from people who disapproved of the project. According to Jacqueline Eccles, board president of the South River Watershed Alliance, everyone was forced just in 2017. They said this would be a park and a community investment. End quote. The questionable land deal pushed through during nationwide lockdowns is better understood in light of several years of heightened social protest stemming from the numerous slayings of unarmed black civilians by homicidal, out-of-control cops across the country, especially after the killings of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri in 2014, George Floyd in Minnesota in 2020, as well as the arrests and deaths of protesters during the BLM demos after Floyd's killing in Atlanta. According to the previous mayor, Democrat Keisha Lance Bottoms, the South River Forest remained the only viable location for Cop City, despite the urgent need for protection of the city's already limited green space. Bottom said at a 2021 press conference that construction of the police militarization facility was, quote, something that can't wait. She also said, I know that everybody is not going to be pleased at our administration's decision to move forward with the project. The entity contracted to implement this project by building Cop City is the Atlanta Police Foundation, a nonprofit private group that supports police and law and order functions through privately arranged and opaque support programs. A corporate finance watchdog group, Little Sis, wrote, quote, police foundations act as a back channel for corporate and wealthy interests to fund policing even further, adding to already overinflated budgets without any required public oversight, approval, or accountability. The APF has provided supplemental funding to expand police surveillance capacity and enhance training, including by committing to pay 2/3 of the Cop City projected $90 million price tag. The Atlanta Police Department is the largest law enforcement agency in the state of Georgia, with a budget of more than $250 million annually. The APF, in turn, receives funding from major companies like Coca-Cola, SunTrust Bank, UPS, Home Depot, Wells Fargo, Cox Enterprises, and private equity-backed Inspire Brand. Dave Wilkinson, president and CEO of the Atlantic Police Foundation, was paid more than $483,000 in 2021. Meanwhile, the mayor's announcement brought out a loose but wide-ranging coalition of critics, including the Georgia chapter of the nation's largest environmental organization, the Nature Conservancy, the South River Watershed Alliance, a veteran of many legal battles on behalf of the river, civic figures like Ryan Gravel, who conceived the Atlanta Beltline, as well as an anonymous media collective who have dug into the fraught history of the prison, and a series of various schools forming a network of hundreds of children and their families and neighborhood associations, including the East Atlanta Community Association and South Atlantans for Neighborhood Development, as well as the Forest Defenders, who spent the past year plus occupying the forest and living in trees in a sustained civil disobedience campaign. Kamau Franklin, an activist, organizer, and lawyer for Community Movement Builders based in Atlanta, was interviewed on Counterspin on March 17th. He discussed the land's history, but also what he regards as the key issue at the center of the entire Cop City controversy, having to do with enhancing the powers and capabilities of American police forces that encourages and buttresses over policing, militarization of cops via tactics and training, as well as equipment. He also discusses the ominous new development of what is being termed a judicial pogrom, perpetrated by all Georgia police forces along with prosecutors, whereby political opponents of expanded cop powers are gunned down or arrested and charged with domestic terrorism.
This land, which has been dubbed by us the Willani Forest, which originally the home of part of the Muskogee Nation. The Muskogee Nation was the native occupiers of that land, the original occupiers of that land. And they were removed in an ethnic cleansing war by the United States from that land and pushed off. And since that time period, the land has been used initially partly as a plantation where enslaved Africans were brought to the land and made to work on that land. Later, the land was transferred into a prison farm where working class people and poor people, and again, particularly Black folks, were put on the land to continue working for state at obviously no wages and being punished and harassed and brutally treated. The land has also served as a youth imprisonment camp, and the police have done trainings on that land. So that land has been, over time period, used for the brutal and harsh treatment of Black people in particular, but also of poor and working class people. One quick thing I want to say also is that that land, in terms of it being a forest before the invention of Cop City, was promised to the adjacent community, which is 70% Black, as a recreational and park area, particularly as the land reforested itself over time. Park area where there were supposed to be nature trails, hiking available, again, parks available. And when the idea of Cop City arose from the Atlanta Police Department, the City of Atlanta, and the Atlanta Police Foundation, all of those plans were scrapped immediately without any input from that adjacent or adjoining community. And instead, they decided to move forward with this idea of Cop City.
Well, I think that's why folks are talking about, I've heard a reference to layers of violence at work here. And I think, you know, that's kind of what they're getting at, is there's what this place would be for, you know, its purpose. And then there's also the process of how it is being pushed on people that didn't want it. And then there's also the physical environmental impact of the construction. It's a lot, and yet they're all intertwined, these problems.
Yeah, this is a perfect illustration of how the state, vis-a-vis the city, the state government, and even in some ways the federal government, operate in tandem. And a lot of times, most of the time, it doesn't matter what party they are, but operate in tandem at the whim of capital and at the whim of a, relatively speaking, right-wing ideological outlook. And again, it doesn't matter which party it is we're talking about. I mean, it doesn't matter whether or not those folks are Black or white, but a ideological outlook that says over-policing in Black and brown communities is the answer to every problem. And so here in particular, you talked about the process. This process of developing Cop City came after the 2020 uprisings against police violence, the 2020 uprisings that were national in scope, that started after Breonna Taylor, George Floyd, and here in Atlanta, Rashard Brooks was killed by the police. And it caused a massive uprising and movement across the nation again. The response by the authorities here in Atlanta were to push through their plans on building Cop City to double down on their efforts. One, again, to continue the over-policing of Black communities, in particular here in Atlanta. Atlanta is a city that is gentrifying at astronomical rates. It's going from a 60% Black city to one that's less than 50% in only a matter of 20, 30 years, all of that under Black leadership. It's a city that, in terms of those who are arrested, 90% of those who are arrested in Atlanta by the police are Black people. Its jails are filled with Black people. And so this is a city that doubled down on police violence or police militarization after these uprisings. In addition, we feel like the part of Cop City, in terms of its militarization, it's over a dozen firing ranges, its mock cities, the practice urban warfare, its military-grade structure that it's bragging about, the fact that its past facility is called the paramilitary center, and this one is also going to be a paramilitary center. In its earliest iterations of what it was supposed to be, it included a landing pad for a Black Hawk helicopter, something they've now said that they've taken out. This, for us, has been put forth to harass and stop future mobilizations and movements and uprisings against police brutality and misconduct. It was pushed through the city council. 70% of the people who called in on the night of the vote voted against Cop City, but yet the city council members decided to still enact this. And so this has been run over the heads of the community without community input. And it is something that we think is dangerous for both the over-policing and, as we stated earlier, the environmental concerns of stripping away a forest of 100 acres immediately. This particular area is something that is akin to having floods, once they start stripping even more of the forested area away, there's going to be even more and increased floods. The loudness of the shootings, the other things that's going to be happening, this is going to be something that's extremely detrimental to the environment and the continued degradation of the climate if it is allowed to take place and happen. People have been protesting against COP City since we found out about it in 2021. And our protests have been, since its beginning, met with police violence. Mm-hmm. When we were protesting at City Hall, doing petition drives, town halls, contacting our legislators, when all that was happening and we were doing protests at City Hall and other places, the police would come and break up our protests. They conducted over 20 arrests during the early stages of our protest movement against COP City. At that particular time, people were being arrested for charges of disorderly conduct, resisting arrest, obstruction of governmental administration. After they passed the resolution to grant the lease to the Atlanta Police Foundation, and part of our tactics began to have, there were folks who moved to the actual forest and became forest defenders as an act of civil disobedience. Then the policing agency in Atlanta basically hooked up and created a task force. So the Atlanta Police Department, the DeKalb County Police Department, Georgia Bureau of Investigation, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and Homeland Security actually formed a task force where they first began having discussions on bringing charges of state domestic terrorism. And so in December of last year, they conducted a raid in the forest and arrested approximately 5 or 6 people. And those were the first folks who were charged with domestic terrorism. On January 18th, they did a second raid, and they charged another 5 or 6 folks with domestic terrorism. And that was the raid in which they killed Tuatagita, the forest defender, activist, and organizer, who, again, through a private autopsy done by the family, because the Georgia Bureau of Investigation refuses to release information on their supposed or alleged investigation into this matter. The private autopsy is the first indication that we have that the police narrative on how he was killed or how they were killed was a complete lie. Mm-hmm. Tuatagita was sitting cross-legged and hands were up to protect their face from the firing directly into their body. They were hit approximately 13 times, and it may be more, but the second autopsy could not determine which were exit wounds and what were entry wounds. After the killing of Tuatagita, another 6 or 7 protesters were arrested at a rally downtown. And then this past Sunday, during our week of action against COP City, another 35 arrests took place, 22 of those people were charged with domestic terrorism. So we now have approximately 41 or 42 people who have been charged with domestic terrorism. And this is a scare tactic meant to demoralize the movement. And it's also meant to criminalize the movement in the eyes of the larger public. And this is something that's been a tactic and strategy of the state since day one. But with the help of corporate media, they are trying to get this narrative out there. And we are left to fight back against this narrative, which is obviously untrue. Your viewers may have seen pictures of property destruction, you know, and again, this movement is autonomous and people are engaged in different actions. We don't equate property destruction with the violence that the police have rained on Black and brown communities over centuries, to mm-hmm. be clear. We don't equate the idea of property destruction with the violent killings that led to the 2020 uprisings and the prior violent killings by the police of unarmed Black people over, again, decades. But what's important to point out, even in these arrests, is that the folks who have been arrested in charge of domestic terrorism were actually involved in acts of civil disobedience at best. Mm-hmm. The people in the forest who were arrested during the first two raids we spoke about were people who were sitting in tree huts and sitting in camps under trees. The police had no evidence whatsoever to suggest that they'd been involved either at that time or prior in any destruction of property. And even if they did have such evidence, then the correct legal charge would be vandalism or destruction of property. These domestic terrorism charges are purposely meant to put fear in the heart of organizers and activists, not only on this issue, but in future issues. When the state levels its power, it's going to say that you trying to, and this is how broad the statute is, mm-hmm. that the attempt to influence government policy by demonstrative means, so by civil disobedience means, can be interpreted as domestic terrorism. And this is the first time in Georgia that the state statute has ever been used. And the first choice to use it on are organizers and activists who are fighting against police violence.
Georgia's current domestic terrorism law, adopted in 2017, ironically following the massacre of 9 black parishioners in Charleston, South Carolina, essentially defines the offense as the commission of any felony meant to, quote, intimidate the civilian population or, quote, alter, change, or coerce the policy of the government, end quote. Most of the dozens of arrested and charged with domestic terrorism have also been denied bail, with seemingly no evidence proffered by state to support remand. Prosecutors in Georgia have been accused of complete politicization of the law and a judicial pogrom in the way they are pursuing charges against activists who dare to defy their government over this criminal miscarriage of justice. For Pacifica Radio and COVID Race and Democracy, this is Thomas O'Rourke in Washington.
Was Grand Funk Railroad, People, Let's Stop the War. This is Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. The U.S. continues to spend hundreds of billions of dollars on the war in Ukraine and the expansion of U.S. military bases around the world, including a nuclear submarine base in the Australian port of Kimberley. The U.S. military budget is moving quickly toward $1 trillion. David Van Dusen, president of the Vermont AFL-CIO, spoke to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer about how the AFL-CIO should respond.
So, David, maybe you can talk about some of the developments facing labor. We talked earlier about the railroad bill signed by both Biden and the Democrats and Republicans that order railroad workers back to work without sick days. Their continuing attacks on unions, their upcoming struggles of the UPS workers and auto workers whose contracts are coming up, and the need for mobilization for United Front for mobilizing the workers is critical. So what is the situation facing workers in 2023? That you see are essential?
I would say that the recent elections of progressive reform candidates and reform slates into various offices in the labor movement is a huge thing. Like, we're talking about O'Brien and Teams for a Democratic Union winning elections recently to head that international. Then we have Fain and that reform slate in the UAW. United for Democracy, sweeping or largely winning elections within recent months and weeks. That's a huge thing. Coupled with the fact that we have very good progressive leadership in APWU with Mark Diamondstein as president, of course, the Flight Attendants Union with Sarah Nelson, and a number of more progressive state and local labor councils across the country, I see labor turning to the working class left. In my mind, that's a direction we've needed to turn to for many decades and haven't. We need to create a departure of ourselves and our politics from the old school way of thinking where we're going to put our eggs in the basket of the Democratic Party. We have to get to the place where we're not afraid to organize, we're not afraid to strike, we're not afraid to exercise our power. In order to do that, we're going to have to see changes both at the local level, the state level, and at the international level. And we're starting to see that now, and that makes me optimistic.
And you're going to be attending a conference in Los Angeles, I understand, around a possible work to form a labor party. The union is a big supporter of the Democrats in the United States. They give them millions and millions of dollars. They supported the Democratic leadership, Nancy Pelosi, and they have a bipartisan policy on war and the expansion of war. How do you see a political development of labor, an independent political party of labor developing in the United States? There was the labor party of led by Mizaki that was formed. How do you see this taking place?
Well, unfortunately, it seems to start and stop in fits, right? There has been historic efforts to create our own party. I think that here in Vermont, I'm proud of the fact that we've gotten behind the Democratic Socialist Vermont Progressive Party in a number of election cycles in a row now, helping them win major office, including the lieutenant governorship in the last election. That's the type of action we're going to have to need to see on a larger scale with resources put into building an alternative to the Democrats and Republicans. One thing that's becoming increasingly clear to union members, rank and file, is the National Democratic Party, by and large, does not stand with us, right? The betrayal of rail workers highlights this. The fact that they were forced to go back to work, had an agreement imposed upon them, essentially by Democratic Party leadership and Joe Biden, it's impossible to say anything other than the fact that they sold this out to their corporate backers. And we see this time and again for year after year after year. And so the rank and file isn't fooled, but the leadership still feels cozy, still feels good about their close personal relationships and what they believe to be proximity to power, not real power, but proximity to it. And we have to break the leadership from that, I don't want to say tradition, we have to break the leadership from that false notion of it's in our best interest to build the Democratic Party, because they're less fascistic, perhaps they're less regressive than aspects of the Republican Party.
The issue of the money that's going to the war in Ukraine, the military budget is reaching nearly $1 trillion, the largest budget in the world. There are over 800 bases as AUKUS, the Australian, US, British military agreement that is being proposed, including a base in and a new nuclear base in Australia that they're having. There's going to be a rally on May 6th against it. Is there an organized effort to rally the U.S. labor movement to oppose militarization and encirclement of China and more bases around the world with the possible world war?
The increasing escalation of the war in the Ukraine is of great concern to me. Our state labor council presently has not taken a position per se on the war. So I'm going to speak for myself here. Many things concern me. But before we get to that, I also want to make clear that I think what Russia has done is terrible. I don't think they were justified invading the Ukraine. And I'm also not going to pretend that they are somehow a progressive force in the world or in Russia itself. But we have to look at some of the realities here. Russia is a nuclear power. Everybody knows that. They have more nuclear weapons than any other nation on the planet other than the United States. And as that conflict gets escalated, and it is a proxy war, if Western, NATO, and American guns and ammunition stop flowing to that conflict zone, the war would be over within a week. We are absolutely, our equipment, our supplies, our money, our tax dollars are supporting that conflict. And as we do, the danger grows. And the danger for that conflict to grow outside the borders of Ukraine becomes, frankly, frightening. Now, when we are going to risk, or if we are ever going to risk a nuclear conflict or world war, or war between large nations with millions and tens of millions of lives at stake, if not more, we have to say, well, who are we defending exactly, right? What is the context in which this risk is taken? And as much as the Russians may overstate the control or influence of Nazis, literally, within the Ukrainian government, the fact remains that since the fall of Franco, the only nation on the planet with actual fascists and Nazis organizes independent units that identify as such, as neo-fascist, within their armed forces is the country of the Ukraine. And since 2014, hundreds of monuments have gone up across that country in honor of those Nazis, Ukrainian Nazis, that played a hand in the death of hundreds of thousands of Jewish people during the Holocaust. Now, the Zelensky government, time and time again, has had a chance to step away from groups like Azov, which are Nazis, to create a division between those on the hard right, the dangerous hard right within their country, and the regular military forces. And instead of doing that, he has propped them up as heroes of the state. He is now integrating the Azov battalion, which are Nazis, into a broader stormtrooper unit tasked with retaking Russian-held territory. Stormtrooper unit. And these folks in Azov wear Nazi emblems. So when I look at two large right-wing countries that are at war with each other, one larger than the other, one more resource than the other, and Russia, of course, was the one that escalated the conflict that was already in the Donbas. But when I look at that, I'm not willing to give my money and my blood and my children's lives to defend folks that think it's okay to have relationships on a national scale, a government to armed forces relationship with actual Nazis. I don't think this is our fight.
AFL-CIO Solidarity Center is funded by the U.S. government, the National Endowment for Democracy, $75 million a year. The AFL-CIO was involved in Ukraine democracy efforts and supporting candidates who were in favor of privatization in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. This year is the 50th anniversary of U.S.-supported coup in Chile that overturned the government, cost the lives of thousands of trade unionist workers and their families. It was supported by the CIA and the AFL-CIO, that coup. And there have been other coups around the world that the AFL-CIO has been involved in through the Solidarity Center. Where do you see this going, and particularly accountability, since most workers are unaware, and particularly workers in the AFL-CIO, CWA, all the different unions, UAW, that the AFL-CIO's international arm is being financed by the U.S. government, and its record is covered up, and its history is one of intervention to support corporate unions, and in the case of Ukraine, actually supporting quote-unquote labor candidates who are in favor of privatization and working with oligarchs, right-wing European oligarchs?
Look, we have a checkered history, for sure. The labor movement in this country has built things like the weekend. The labor movement in this country has lifted more people out of poverty than any other social force in the United States of America. But the conservative elements of the labor movement, which have essentially been in power in many internationals and with the national AFL-CIO, largely, not always, but largely since the 1950s, have got in bed with the wrong characters at different times. Now, if we're going to build a movement to really challenge the billionaire class, the rich, the powerful, the elite, those that don't want your kids to be able to have the rights or the resources that we know as workers that they need to have, those that would rather take that money, such as like resources for free college tuition, and put that in their bank accounts or pay it back to their shareholders, those folks are not the ones that we should be designing, taking money from with strings attached and designing policy around. What we need to do is build international solidarity with unions all across the globe, working people all across the globe, to not just try to break the chain of oppression and capitalism and the billionaires here in the United States, but at many links all around the world, because that's the only way we're going to beat it. Capital is international, and therefore labor and the labor movement has to be international too. We need a labor foreign policy which is squarely anti-imperialist, which is squarely for the liberation of workers and the empowerment of workers all around the world. And we need to be unafraid to send resources to those places where they're engaged in struggle. Now, when we talk about receiving essentially government money to prop up conservative or right-wing or non-labor-centric policies around the globe, that needs to stop. And we shouldn't take a penny where there's strings attached. That's all to it. That's just the right thing to do. But right now, I think it's very important that we talk the truth, that we publicly speak out on such issues, and we talk with the rank and file about what's in our interests internationally. Because I'll tell you what, the average machinist, the average construction worker, the average nurse, They're not looking into the books and saying, well, hey, what is the AFL-CIO engaged in Colombia? What is the AFL-CIO engaged in Venezuela, right? It's the furthest thing from their mind. I mean, hell, it would be a leap if the 12.5 million members of the AFL-CIO across the country, as a starting point, understood squarely what the AFL-CIO is and what it has the potential to do as far as a vehicle for change goes. But certainly, they're not thinking about the Solidarity Center and things like this. So that's something that we need to bring the folks as a discussion, because we need to model ourselves as an internal labor democracy to our conventions, to our members, at union meetings, to begin to build awareness. A lot of folks don't even know that we have what amounts to a foreign policy, right, as a national labor movement. So why don't we start with there and remind folks that the labor movement's actually there to be the embodiment and articulation of their desires, their beliefs, their goals. And then let's further hammer home that any international stances we take need to uphold and reflect those values that they have as a group, as a collective, as workers.
That was David Van Dusen, president of the Vermont AFL-CIO, speaking with Pacifica Steve Zeltzer.
Never say that you have reached the very end, when leaden skies a bitter future may portend. For sure the hour for which we yearn will yet arrive, and our marching steps will thunder we survive. For sure the hour for which we yearn will yet arrive, and our marching steps will thunder we survive. Not late but blood inscribed this bitter song we sing. 'Tis not a caroling of birds upon the wing, but 'twas a people amidst the crashing fires of hell that sang this song and fought courageous till it fell. But 'twas a people amidst the crashing fires of hell that sang this song and fought courageous till it fell.
A classic by Paul Robeson from Pacifica's Freedom Ways tribute. You're listening to Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. As the world honors the 125th birthday of the artist and revolutionary Paul Robeson, his fight against racism and fascism is as relevant today as ever. Here is Esther Iverum, host and producer of On the Ground from Pacifica's WPFW in the nation's capital, in conversation with Robeson's biographer, Professor Gerald Horn.
We're marking the 125th birthday of Paul Robeson, the actor, orator, athlete, lawyer, singer, author, scholar, linguist, and activist. Here in D.C., I've been kind of shepherding this special week of celebration here at WPFW. And in the process, I've heard you expound on Robeson on other birthdays, like listening to audio in the archives. It could have been his 80th birthday or his 100th birthday. Also speaking to a longtime Pacifica producer, AC Bird, here at WPFW. As I listened to just so many valuable recordings this week, I started to wonder if there's anything more to say other than the amazing story of his life at the 125th anniversary of his birth. Is there any story more important than to just tell the story of his life?
I think so. First, a historical point, and then a point concerning the ongoing legacy of Robeson. I find it fascinating that Robeson, as early as the 1940s, said that in order to prepare him psychologically to play the role of Shakespeare's Othello, who, recall, was betrayed tremendously during the course of that play, that he imagined that he would be betrayed by his closest comrade, speaking of the Black communist lawyer, Ben Davis Jr., who had been elected to the New York City Council in 1943, reelected in 1945, before put on trial in 1949 and slapped in federal prison. And then there's the legacy of Robeson. It should be clear to the most dense by now that if Robeson's advice concerning a friendship with Moscow had been followed, the United States, and including U.S. imperialism, would not have embarked upon this anti-Soviet entente with the People's Republic of China that led to massive direct foreign investment in China, which has now created this juggernaut. And now, as we speak, there are massive U.S. military maneuvers in the Philippines off the coast of China, China's maneuvers off the coast of the rebel province of Taiwan, all a direct result of not adhering to the legacy of Paul Robeson. And assuming that humanity is not overwhelmed by climate change or nuclear war, I dare say that a century from now, we'll still be able to draw lessons from the immense legacy of one Paul Robeson.
I think that when I talked about just telling the story of his life, it's just it's such an amazing life when you think about him being born in 1898. And when I listened to the interview with Dorothy Gilliam that she did after she wrote her biography in the 70s, she just talked about how that was just 2 years after the Plessy versus Ferguson Supreme Court case, which set up this so-called separate but equal system of apartheid that would last for, you know, almost the next century. And how, despite that, he thrived despite all that and despite all the obstacles in his way. And even now, more than a century later, there are still like important lessons, you know, for young people in our communities about that. And so that, I guess that's what I really meant. But when you talked about, you know, current events in China and today's Russia, formerly the Soviet Union, I thought about when I was leaving the Washington Post, and I don't know if I told you this story before, because I know I interviewed you when your biography came out, Paul Robeson, the artist as revolutionary, in 2016. But at the point that I was leaving the Post, I could not get my article on Paul Robeson into the paper. It just like couldn't happen. This was the centennial of Paul Robeson's birth, and I was working in the style section. And so the editor of the style section said to me, well, you know, Paul Robeson wound up on the wrong side of history. And so my story was supposed to say that. And it was obviously it wasn't going to say that. So that quickly led to the end of my tenure there, my voluntary exit. And it's funny you mentioned, you know, all these current events, because I was just thinking the same thing, that even if I think about everything that happened after that incident in the late 90s, when I think about the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan, the destruction of Libya, and even now this, you know, hysterical attempt to, you know, prevent China's rise and, you know, Russia's influence in its own region, I think about the arrogant blindness of that statement by the editor and how right Paul Robeson was, and that he wasn't on the wrong side of history. And so I guess as an historian, I want you to kind of react to my experience.
First of all, one of the possible demerits of Paul Robeson is that he really didn't write that much. He wrote a slim memoir, Here I Stand. He was not a consummate writer of letters like his comrade W.E.B. Du Bois. But in the early 1950s, he did write a foreword to a memoir written by a Filipino revolutionary, Luis Taruk, which I just read the other day. And he mentions that he was born in 1898, as the traditional story goes, when U.S. imperialism was taking off with jet propulsion, with the knockout blow delivered to the tottering Spanish Empire, grabbing Guam and Philippines and Puerto Rico and Cuba and other territories as well. And it's not perhaps coincidental that the accelerated takeoff of U.S. imperialism takes place as one of its staunchest opponents, speaking of Paul Robeson, enters the planet Earth. And certainly, I would hope that if that editor you mentioned is still around, that said editor would recognize that by grappling toe-to-toe with an emergent fascism beginning in the 1930s, and grappling with lynching of Black people as a leader of a premier anti-lynching organization, and then filing a petition with the United Nations under the aegis of the Civil Rights Congress, now defunct, but then led by another close comrade, speaking of another Black communist lawyer, William L. Patterson, which brought U.S. imperialism and white supremacy into the worldwide dock, which created inordinate pressure on U.S. imperialism to retreat from the more egregious aspects of white supremacy, which then began to take place in the 1950s on into the 1960s. But as a direct result, there was a ritualistic sacrifice of Paul Robeson. That is to say, his income plummeted from the six figures to the low four figures. There were attempts on his life. His passport was snatched. There was an attempt to destroy him, to keep him from performing in concert halls from the Atlantic to the Pacific, until a global movement arose that allowed his passport to be returned, in which case he then embarked on a worldwide tour that was somewhat overwhelming in terms of not only his health, but the health of his spouse, Eslanda Good Robeson. She dying prematurely about 11 years or so before his unfortunate, untimely passing in 1976. And so I would hope that your editor, who I assume is a literate person, would acquaint himself or herself with the basic facts, and perhaps might want to revise that wrong-headed idea that Mr. Robeson was on the wrong side of history.
The Shrivenese does lead mit Blut und nicht mit Blei. Sie sind der Lied von seiner Feugel auf der Frei. Das hat er voll zwischen Fahnen dicker Wind. Das Lied gesungen mit Nackammes in die Hände. Das hat er voll zwischen Fahnen dicker Wind. Das Lied gesungen mit Nackammes in die Hände.
That was a clip from On the Grounds, host's producer Esther Evarim's tribute to Paul Robeson, featuring Professor Gerald Horn. Dr. Horn is the author of more than 30 books, including Paul Robeson, The Artist as Revolutionary, published in 2016, a reviewer posted online, "This book is a tremendous account of one of the greatest men of the 20th century. As the great Gerald Horn makes clear, Paul Robeson was an icon, not just due to his immense globally recognized talent as an actor, athlete, and scholar, but because of his principled stance as a champion for the masses of oppressed and colonized people throughout the world." To hear the entire discussion, visit the website onthegroundshow.org. On May 1st, CRD will present labor programming from around the U.S. and around the world. CRD will also have a page with the video and links for workers in the United States and around the world. Please contact us with your rally action and struggles on May Day 2023. Write to labormedia1@gmail.com. That's labormedia1@gmail.com. And that concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by executive producers Akua Holt, Paulina Basilia, and Steve Zeltzer. You can find this in all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on Twitter at PacificaCRD, and on Facebook at COVID, Race, and Democracy. I've been your host, Akua Holt. Thanks for listening. Before we go, I leave you with this quote. "The answer to injustice is not to silence the critic, but to end the injustice." The great Paul Robeson.